On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Atrolado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Atrolado in the description of this episode or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elatrolado.org/volunteer. El Atrolado, ALOTROLADO.org/volunteer.
Particularly in our society, we as Black men have a certain role, a certain place in the consciousness of America. And so you have to make sure that you are ready for whatever those situations that may present themselves. And it might mean that you may be hypervigilant and all the rest of these things. And so one of the things that MDMA, heroin, all of these things help me to do is to recalibrate and help me to understand that you have to be human, regardless of all the shit that they might put on you. You have to be human, and you have to take every situation anew. You just because somebody looks like what you consider a Trump supporter doesn't mean that that's who they are, or that doesn't mean that's the whole of their personality. So you have to take them anew, and my drug use helps me to remember that, to help, it helps me to engage each situation and people, each person anew. And because precisely that, I want to be in that space where you said with Molly, and where you are empathetic and you're caring and you're sappy, whatever they call it, but you are a better human as a result. And that's where I want to be.
Dr. Carl Hart is a major drug researcher who occasionally does heroin because there's absolutely nothing wrong with thoughtful usage of anything. If I said he sometimes uses whiskey, you'd be like, what's the big deal? If I said he sometimes smokes a joint, you'd be like, okay, well, what's wrong with thoughtful usage of heroin every once in a while? He gets into his thoughts on using drugs responsibly, even quote-unquote hard drugs. There's no real difference between what we think of as hard drugs and what we think of as, what would you call it, soft drugs. We talk about the war on drugs. We talk about the impact that drugs have on you and the way that the criminalization and stigmatization of drugs has had a massive negative effect on our experiences in life. It would actually be really valuable for some of us to take that trip that you can only get to that place where you're on LSD, where you're on ayahuasca, where you're on heroin, and see what you're like there. If it sounds crazy, you gotta listen to the doctor. For half of this interview, stay right here. For the whole interview, which is highly, highly interesting and informative, patreon.com/Toure Show. patreon.com/Toure Show. Just $5 a month. You get our Friday Patreon exclusives. You get the entirety of our Wednesday interviews, and you help support our growing team. Let's get into it. It's Dr. Carl Hart, the author of Drug Use for Grownups, talking about how grownups can use drugs in a grown-up way. It's Dr. Carl Hart on Toure Show. Do you do heroin, like, all the time?
That's like asking, does somebody do alcohol all the time? No. It doesn't work like that. Just think about sex. Do you have sex all the time? No. Yeah, I know. But we got to work. Like, you and I are sitting here working now. We got stuff to do. And also with heroin, we have this additional sort of restriction in that it's illegal. And then if you want to be healthy and that sort of thing, you got to make sure that you got good stuff. And like me, I like to make sure that I get my stuff from the source. So I'm typically in Europe or something like that if I get heroin. And I don't buy it and I can't do that sort of thing. I don't want to get caught out there like that. So it's all kinds of planning and all this sort of thing that goes into it, man. And that we can think about a pandemic. It's just not conducive for that kind of lifestyle for me, because I can't get what I like.
But you use it as regularly as you can.
Yeah. Just like alcohol or anything like that. For example, if I had a choice and if I had like Afghanistan heroin and alcohol available to me the night, it wouldn't even be a choice, or whatever night it might be. Whether it's Tuesday night or Saturday night, heroin is a far better choice for me because there are no hangover effects. And also, I like the place where I get. And that place is like a place of forgiving, more able to hear, understand. And I can be more understanding. In general, more magnanimous. I can be forgiving of people and empathetic, and it helps. It's nice for me to reevaluate the impact of my behavior on other people, on the environment, on the society. And heroin helps me to like be in a space where I can do that.
With a lot of people, especially me, knows what the inside of marijuana feels like and some other things. I never did heroin. I just think about Diana Ross, you know, what was it? Lady Sings the Blues, when, you know, it goes in and she just slumps like, yes, this is heaven, you know, and Trainspotting, where they like slump like, yes, this is heaven. The body gets like all limp and loose. So what is the internal feeling that you get when it gets into you?
Yeah, so like, to be clear, most of those movies, they get it wrong. Like, okay, in the book, I talk about Trainspotting and that bullshit that they have perpetuated. and when they get it wrong, there's a price that we pay in society. That price is that we overregulate and we are overly punitive,
yes,
because of the way they get it wrong. we have this image of the heroin user as someone in the grips of this drug's addiction, and it's so powerful that we as a society has to help them. When in fact, society should be helping people with health care, making sure people have jobs, all that sort of thing protects against folks getting in trouble with drugs. So that's number one, they get it wrong. And this sort of slump, that means that you probably hit the dose too high. That's like an overdose. That's not the best place to be. If you use heroin, and particularly when it's illegal, that means you have to go through some great deal of obstacles to get it. Why do you want to miss your drug effect by being sedated like that? With heroin, it helps me to feel more, and I want to be tuned in so I can, you know, work out some stuff or enjoy the moment, whatever it might be, or enjoy my company, whatever the case may be. And so in the movies, when they show the poor person with the needle in their arm or something, and they're like nodding, they're missing out on the best effects of heroin. And so that looks sexy, and that's sensationalistic, and that's going to ensure that viewers watch your shit. But it ain't reality, not for the most of us. And so it wouldn't be bad if people are doing this and they're getting viewers. The bad part is that we got to pay the price by your drug laws. Your drug laws flow from that sort of misrepresentation. And people like you and me, we pay the price.
I mean, the thing, from what I'm getting from you, part of what we want to teach young adults and kids, it is okay to use drugs in moderation, and by moderation, like, not every day, and don't blow it out, don't get blasted, like if it was alcohol, don't get drunk to where you're throwing up over the toilet isn't fun, but having a couple of glasses of wine where you get a nice buzz, that feels, and then you can walk out on your own power, that feels nice. So use a little heroin or a little cocaine so you get a little rush, right? And you can feel it, right? And you can be conscious of, okay, I'm hovering here, rather than you don't want to blow out your consciousness to where you can't pay attention to anything.
Absolutely. We can think about young people in college who are below the age of 21. We can see how when they get an opportunity to drink, some of them just overdo it because they don't know when they're going to get this opportunity again. So you can imagine people using a drug like heroin like that because they don't know when they're going to get this opportunity again because it's illegal and all of this sort of social stigma around it, surrounding it. The same is true like with alcohol. We see this behavior with alcohol and we understand. But when it comes to heroin, we act like we don't understand. It is logical, reasonable. When you have a substance that's illegal like this, yeah, you're going to see some behavior that's inappropriate. You're going to see some behavior that we don't approve of. That's right.
Is heroin your personal favorite drug?
It's like asking, is the missionary position your favorite position? You know, it's like, it depends on the activity in which I am engaged in. You know, like if I have my wife, my significant other, MDMA might be the choice there, or this drug called 6-APB. But if I'm chilling like with my friends from Paris, you know, the brothers in Paris and what's going on there, where in that society, they pretend that race doesn't exist. And we're having these conversations. And heroin is great for those conversations. Opium is great for those conversations. That's the drug that we like to use in that situation. Whereas MDMA would be for another situation, or whereas cocaine will be for another situation. So it depends on the situation in which I am engaged.
I have a deeply ingrained memory of being with my wife when she was my girlfriend, and we got some Molly, right? MDMA. Yeah. And it was we had like the sweetest conversation ever, and it was like the most caring moment ever, and we were like talking about like our grandmothers and like we should go visit them more, and like the depth of the sweetness was almost overpowering, like, which I would not be able to access straight, I'd be like, this is too saccharine. I'm shutting down now. But like with that, and it was a very loving moment. It really stands out in the memory.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that you wouldn't be able to access that without the Molly in that moment. And I dig it because I'm the same way. Particularly in our society, we as Black men have a certain role, certain place in the consciousness of America. And so you have to make sure that you are ready for whatever those situations that may present themselves. And it might mean that you may be hypervigilant and all the rest of these things. And so one of the things that MDMA, heroin, all of these things help me to do is to recalibrate and help me to understand that you have to be human, regardless of all the shit that they might put on you. You have to be human, and you have to take every situation anew. You just because somebody looks like what you consider a Trump supporter doesn't mean that that's who they are, or that True. That doesn't mean that's the whole of their personality. So you have to take them anew, and my drug use helps me to remember that. It helps me to engage each situation and people, each person, anew. And because precisely that, I want to be in that space where you said with Molly, and where you are empathetic and you're caring and you're sappy, whatever they call it, but you are a better human as a result. And that's where I want to be.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I just had a brother on the show who made a documentary about crack. And one of the points that he was making, it was less the usage and more the sellers who helped create that Black male sort of cold-hearted, cold-faced sort of thing. Like, the sellers were like, we can't ever show weakness. We can't smile. We can't laugh. We can't dance. you know, we can't like do and show anything because the other killers will think, oh, we're weak, and then try to kill us and take our real estate. And that sense of like, black man, never smile, never break your, you know, your cool, that sort of pervaded throughout the culture in a lot of ways. It definitely came through rappers and into the culture. What do you think about that idea?
Was that Stanley, film?
Stanley Nelson.
Yeah, I'm in that film.
Yep, you are.
Yeah, I think they do a bad job, the filmmakers, the makers of New Jack City, Van Peebles, all of those folks, they are the reason that we have this image and not the other way around. Don't get it twisted. It's those filmmakers that perpetuate this nonsense. You were there in the 80s. I was there. And when we think about New Jack City and these kind of things, New Jack City, the writer of the original screenplay, Tom Wright, not the brother. They brought the brother on after Tom Wright had written New Jack City, which was originally Godfather 3. And then I talk about this in the book. But they weren't going to have like a black star or a black person be featured in Godfather 3. So they sold this script to Paramount, I believe, and Quincy Jones got it. And we have New Jack City now. What they did, they vilified black youth. The writer Michael Cooper or something.
Barry Michael Cooper.
They vilified black youth, and it was based on this whole. It was based on a Village Voice piece. Yep. Of the situation that happened in Detroit.
Yep.
And you read that Village Voice piece, I mean, it's just filled with sensationalistic garbage. But it was put off as black youth were somehow different from other youth. In that piece, the original Guardian piece, the original Village Voice piece, even LL Cool J was talked about as he was a thug, you know, like Milk Toast LL Cool J talked about in these terms. And so it's the filmmakers and the writers who perpetuate this nonsense. Black men, black boys, whatever, they have a range of emotions. It's just that these folks decided to focus in on that emotion. And that's the image that has been, that has gone forward in our society. So I blame the filmmakers. This is not on those youth. I mean, those youth were just out there talking shit like they always. But that's the shit that you decide to focus on. Mm. And that's the problem. I was a part of that generation.
I want to talk about that, but before we get there, how do we normalize drug use in our society the same way it's totally polite and normal to drink wine or whiskey or what have you, you know, in front of your grandmother and mixed company, by yourself, what have you. But using drugs is like, oh my God, you know, you're going to smoke a joint. Oh my God. Like, that's a big deal societally, you know, forget. You know, use heroin. You don't normally say like, I go home and sniff a line of cocaine. It's not a big deal. Like, just one, I'm under control. Like, what? You're out of control. Heroin, what have you. How do we get to normalizing these things? So it's like, I drink wine. I sniff a little cocaine. It's fine. It's cool.
Yeah. Think about how we started this interview. Your first question you asked about heroin. And then we just explode. It was no big deal. That's how you do it. Middle class folks, people who are from the privileged class, all of these closeted drug users who are responsible, who are handling their responsibility, who are happy, who treat people well, they need to get out of the closet. That's how we change it. And that will help to lessen the stigma, that will help make us less likely to pigeonhole drug users as these irresponsible degenerates, which is inconsistent with the evidence and the truth. And so We change it by privileged class people getting out of the closet and having this honest adult conversation. We change it by when we see people like Stephen Colbert or Seth Meyers, who I love that what they do. But when they're on TV making these inane adolescent jokes about drug users, we call them out and we say, what the fuck is that? You know, that's not reality. That's just some cheap joke that doesn't comport with reality. But that's how we change it.
Because I feel like that is an important step toward legalization. To talk about marijuana should be legal, that's no longer a radical statement. But even 5 years ago, that would have been a radical statement. But to say all drugs should be legal, you should be able to put whatever you want in your body, that's a very radical statement, and people would freak out, and it would almost disqualify you from the political sort of intellectual conversation. When I'm like, why is that not an idea that a reasonable intellectual person could hold?
It's a radical idea for those who don't understand the founding principles of the country. Which guarantees us all life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, so long as we don't disrupt other people's ability to do the same, right? Now, that means that you can live your life however you choose, if you really understood what the Declaration guaranteed, if you really understood that the Declaration said that a government should be created to secure these rights, and when governments fail in securing these rights, governments should be disbanded. So those folks don't understand what it means to be American, and we have to remind them what it means to be American. And they will understand that this ain't radical. This is just allowing people the liberty that we say we get, that we say they are entitled to. This is just allowing people to pursue happiness as they see fit. That's all it is. And so the government has a role there. The government's role is to ensure quality control, to maybe.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
put some requirements on whether people can obtain these substances, use it. So like you might have to be a certain age. You might have to pass a competency exam. You may have to pass some requirements, but these things are available and they have a certain level of quality control. That's the government's role.
I'm Danielle Moody.
I'm Toure.
Be sure to check out Democracy-ish, where we channeled the frustration, rage, and absurdity that was the 2020 election, as well as discuss the current state of the political climate and our country from a Black perspective.
New episodes available every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you stream your podcasts. I have long felt, and I know you agree, that the war on drugs has been far more damaging to America and to Black America in particular than drugs themselves have been.
Yes. So the war on drugs, we have to understand, is a jobs program. And so the goal was never to rid the community of drugs. The goal was to kind of divert attention away from the fact that the Rust Belt had lost all those factories to other countries because there was cheaper labor and those middle class jobs were gone. The war on drugs functioned as a nice substitute for some where jobs could be obtained in law enforcement. Prisons could be built. The hotels and restaurants surrounding the prisons could also thrive. Drug testing, where urine testing centers could now make money. All of these people made a lot of money and are making money. People who are in drug treatment, some of them are getting over, because we know that drug addiction has almost nothing to do with drugs. If we wanted to make sure people were treated with drug addiction, we would make sure they have health care, make sure they had gainful employment, all of these things we know. So on the one hand, there's a wink and nod. People know, at least adults know, that the war on drugs has nothing to do with drugs. It's about jobs. We know that, right? And so, but they tell the public, the naive public, most people know that that's nonsense and that's not the goal. And so that's when we face that, and then we face the fact that this jobs program is predicated largely on the incarceration of Black and brown bodies. The evidence showed this. Black men make up 6% of the general population, but damn near 40% of the incarcerated population. That is outrageous. 6% of the population, 40% of the incarcerated population. And largely because of this war on drugs.
Right.
And we know it, but it still happens. And the real trick is that we got Black America to buy into this jobs program. That's the real trick. You know, back in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, the Black Congressional Caucus, 80-90% of those guys voted for these laws that were more restrictive, and the consequence of these laws were more incarcerated Black and brown bodies. That's the real trick. I mean, it's like, wow, how do you convince people to participate in their own subjugation? I mean, that's the trick. That's the real trick.
I mean, you're right. I think a lot of folks may not realize there's a lot of towns in the Midwest, in the further West, where the main industry in the town is the prison, right? And the prison funds all, like you outlined, all the activity around there. Even if you're not working in the prison, you might be servicing the prison with linens, with food, what have you, servicing the people who need to come to the prison. So, you know, yeah, it is interesting. And not just as a jobs program, but we can seize all kinds of money from, not even if you are convicted, if you are just suspected of having sold drugs on X property, we can seize that property prior to trial. So,
yes.
Right, when they're showing, like, look, all these drugs, look at all this money we stole, they just keep all that money.
They just keep that yacht, and it, you know, they'll auction it off at some point, and then so
we could just go into the community and just take stuff from various citizens. Like, yes, this is great for government, but it's not making any difference. The amount of drugs that is in the country is not less. The price of drugs that is in the country is not less. So the war on drugs has been a complete failure from a preventing drug standpoint.
Yes, that was never the goal. That was the sort of stated goal, wink and nod to people who weren't paying attention. And when we say government benefits, let's be clear. It ain't the federal government per se. It's these local governments that have the sheriff, like Louisiana, they're sheriffs in that state. They're getting over. I mean, they have like one of the highest incarceration rates in the country, and black bodies are behind bars, and the local sheriffs are benefiting. Upstate New York, throughout this state, the main industry in many of these towns is the prison industry. So we don't have to go far. Wherever people are at, check out their local prison population, and then you will see the oppressed people of that society.
I mean, the entire history of drug prohibition has been based around racism, from an assault on jazz musicians to hippies to the welfare queen, crack baby, Len Bias sort of people in the 80s. It's always been based around policing us, even though you and I know it is quite easy to go on to any college campus, Yale, Harvard, Stanford, whatever, and score whatever it is that you want to do. But you almost never see police raids on major colleges. But the hood is like it operates like a prison that we haven't arrested you yet.
Yes. Because the black community, and I use that term very generally, has been okay with the police raiding that community. In fact, we've had people who have invited the police in the community, yes. And then the politicians would say, well, black people asked for this. And it's like, well, black people ask for jobs, they ask for better education, all of these things, but this is what you give them.
They were also sold a lie that drug use in your community is out of control, and it is the reason for violence and other problems. So you need to be part of helping us help you.
Yes. And politicians will say, you said that to us. And it's like the story that it feeds in this sort of loop. You say it, and then they say it, and then it becomes reality. When in fact, the problems were there long before crack cocaine. That's just one example. So, like, the peak unemployment rates in the United States occurred in 1982. Yet, crack was blamed for unemployment, even though crack didn't show up on the scene till about 1985. Crack was blamed for all of these things.
Well, I mean, one of the key lies of the whole situation is the myth of the gateway drug, which is, like you referenced before, that drugs are so powerful that almost anybody, if you smoke a little marijuana, you'll want more, that will make you want other drugs, and your life will soon be ruined by addiction to cocaine or heroin or something much harder. So we must prevent you from acquiring any drugs at all. You're a scientist. That whole math is totally incorrect.
Yeah, so the gateway idea theory confuses causation with correlation. So causation, it happens when something causes an event, like I move my hand and my force causes my hand to move. That's causation. A correlation is something like when it rains, we have more umbrellas that are up in the air. Now, somebody from outer space will come and see like all of these umbrellas, and they notice that when it rains, there are more umbrellas up in the air. And now somebody who's not so smart might confuse it and say, oh, the rain is causing. The umbrellas are causing the rain, you know, and so that's confusing causation with correlation. And that's what the gateway theory does. And I'll tell you how. It basically says that when you use marijuana, then you will use heroin, the harder drugs like heroin or cocaine. Now, it is true that many of the people who use heroin use marijuana before using heroin. But it's also true that the vast majority of users of marijuana never go on to use heroin.
Right.
And it's also true, too, that many people who use heroin use milk before, or drank milk before using heroin as a younger person. But no one would say that milk causes you to use heroin. It's also true that the prior three president, not including Trump, he hasn't admitted this, but three of the four last presidents all smoked marijuana.
Right.
Now, we could say that marijuana leads to the White House. Marijuana use leads to the White House. That would be illogical, and that's wrong. Yeah, that would be wrong, right?
I think I've long thought that the notion that we should prevent everyone from getting drugs leads to the notion of prohibition, but they know the demand will never stop. So we have a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States that is not controlled or regulated by the United States, is completely controlled by homicidal people who live in another country, be it Colombia or Mexico or what have you. That, just on a global scale, makes no sense. There is no other multi-billion dollar industry that touches almost every aspect of society that the American government is like, we have no control over that.
That's a great point. I've never put it like that. That's exactly right. It's a multi-billion dollar industry that's, that our government has no role in besides making it better. Our government has a role in sharpening the organizations who are involved. Because if you're going to stay in a business where that is restricted so much so, where the U.S. government will put all these resources in stopping it, you have to be really good to survive. You have to be really vertically organized, and you have to be ruthless to survive. So our government is putting this sort of evolutionary pressure on it such that these organizations get better, more efficient. So that's the role our government is playing, but we're not making any money, the American citizens. What we're doing is just that we are spending money on making these folks better.
You know, a lot of people talk about the crack era, and it was huge from 1984 to around 1992. And they want to talk about what happened in the crack era, but I've tried to do some reading on why it stopped. And there doesn't seem to be criminologists, sociologists don't have a clear understanding of, like, in 92, around 1992, crack use kind of drops off of a cliff. And just society in general seems to say, like, okay, we're not doing that anymore. And we haven't really seen that in society of, like, a drug, like, shooting to popularity and then falling off in popularity. What is your theory as to why in the early 90s, most Americans were like, oh, no, we're not doing that anymore?
Okay, so let's be clear. Like, crack shows up in the national conscious in December 1984. The LA Times report the first article on crack. New York Times a year later would do the same. So it really didn't come into the American psyche until 1986, really. And when it came in through the American psyche in full force in the summer of 1986. Len Bias dies a week later. Don Rogers, the Cleveland Browns cornerback, he dies. People initially said that they died of a crack-related death. Neither one of them had smoked crack. Crack wasn't involved, but the story had already left the gates, and so America believed that crack was involved. Congress passed a law in September 1986 punishing crack cocaine violations 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine violations, meaning that you just need a small amount of crack to trigger a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 5 years. To trigger the same sentence for powder cocaine, you need to have 100 times as much powder cocaine. Now, October 1986, Ronald Reagan signs a proclamation declaring October 1986 Crack Cocaine Awareness Month. So all of that is happening from the summer to October 1986. December 1986, James Baldwin gives a talk for the National Press Club, saying that this is crazy. And he's imploring the black politician to legalize drugs, because he says this law could, in operation, can only hurt poor black and brown people. That's what James Baldwin said, 1986. Fast forward, more than 30 years later, he was absolutely right.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about crack use going up and then coming off. Crack use was always extremely low. Very few people used crack. But the optics of black young men on the corner saying they're selling crack was just too much for the American mainstream. It was just too beautiful. And then the brother who wrote the Guardian piece, I mean, the
Village Voice
piece, that would combine with New Jack City, all of these kind of imagery, it was great. It was an easy way to vilify black men by mainstream, because the handcuffs were off because they're saying, you did this. It was you. We're just following your lead. The handcuffs are off. They threw my generation, I was a part of this generation. I come home, I was in the Air Force at the time, and my friends, they would say, they were on the corner slinging or selling crack. All of them were telling me how much loot they were making. Yet they were at home living with their mom, no car, all of this stuff. So it just conflicted with reality. And then when the studies were finally done, what we determined was that these cats were making about as much as they would have been making in a McDonald's suit. They were making about the same amount as fast food restaurant. So this here myth about the savageness of these guys, the amount of money they were making, all of this is just myth. And how widespread crack use was, it's a myth. White people always use crack cocaine more than black people. So all of this just conflicts with the reality. And like you said, what happened? Crack didn't go anywhere. The same numbers of people still use crack. They still smoke cocaine. But it's always been a relatively low number, in part because when you smoke cocaine, the effects are so rapid, so immediate. Why do you want to blow your high that quickly? And also, you also run the risk of burning away some of the cocaine. It's like you might as well take it orally. The effects are felt in quick enough time. It's quickly, fairly quickly, and they last longer. And so, like, why do you want to waste your money like that?
For more fascinating conversations about drugs from me and Dr. Hart, join us right now at patreon.com/Touré Show. The rest of the show is more mind-blowing conversation that will make you feel like, hey, it's fine to do drugs sometimes. Thanks so much to Dr. Hart for a fantastic interview, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Keena Murphy, and Earl Dorsey. Touré Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Touré, and on Instagram at Touré Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/Touré Show. Touré Show is written by me, Touré, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shonda Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests, because the man can't shut us down.